I titled this sermon, Standing Firm Against the Tide. And it's really inspired by a talk I heard from an Oxford mathematician who's become an apologist named John Lennox. And he was giving a defense of the gospel, a defense of the Bible, and he used Daniel, and I thought, man, that's some really good points. So at least some of the points are going to be taken directly from him, but I'm going to more sermonize it. It's going to be less secular than his talk. But as we were talking in class this morning, it made me think of Daniel chapter 4, and I wanted to start there, kind of start at the beginning, or have the beginning be the actual end. What is the end? Well, it's the same conclusion that Nebuchadnezzar came to. At the end of everyone's road, eventually every knee is going to bow and every tongue is going to confess that Jesus is Lord. And that's what Nebuchadnezzar came to realize as he was humbled. You remember how the story started? If you stay in chapter 4 here, in verse 28, all this happened to Nebuchadnezzar the king. 12 months later, he was walking on the roof of the royal palace of Babylon, and the king reflected and said, now think about, first, before we keep reading, think about that. He's walking on the roof of this glorious city, Babylon. As we see in Daniel chapter 2, Babylon is the head of gold. It is the most glorious, the most prominent of all of the empires, including more glorious than the Greeks who conquered the world under Alexander the Great, including more glorious than the Romans who, you know, our civilization is basically based on the Greeks and the Romans. We think we are great, but we are only the shadow of what was before. But even those two kingdoms could not compare to Babylon. Now, how was Babylon great? We're not really told. Was it just that it had so much wealth, so much power? Was it so much wisdom? They did have an incredible amount of wisdom. The things they could do with mathematics are, quite frankly, almost unthinkable. In the time before paper, in the time before computers, they were using base 60 to do things, to calculate things, to calculate the rotation of the spheres, to calculate all these wonderful things that you would say that is impossible for anybody in that time to calculate. Yet they did it. They were very wise, very skilled, had a lot of knowledge, and you could see it all around them. You look here, you look there, you see wonders, architectural wonders, wonders in medicine, wonders in mathematics, all these things that are saying what? Look at this great civilization that I've built. And who's the head of this great civilization? It's Nebuchadnezzar. And he's looking around, and with all due humility, he has to say, my eyes aren't lying. I see all these wonders. I see all these great things. I see that we are the peak of humanity. And with all due humility, I must say, I need a pat on the back. Is this not Babylon the Great, which I myself have built as a royal residence by the might of my power and for the glory of my majesty? Look at all this. Can you deny how great it is? You couldn't. You'd have to say, wow, that's incredible. But what's the problem? Well, it's what God shows him. Don't forget, you're not at the top of the food chain, Nebuchadnezzar. There's someone above you. There's someone who has authority over you. And I can put you down in the ground when I want to. And I can lift you back up when I want to, as God shows him. God does put him down in the ground to be like an animal. And then God raises him up. Did you notice what Larry read? Even higher. I have power to do both. Don't forget it. Okay, let's turn over to Daniel chapter 1. Daniel chapter 1. What's the setting for Daniel? Do you remember? You remember several months ago we talked about Lamentations. And what was Lamentations all about? It's Jeremiah lamenting over the fall of Jerusalem. He has these five laments, these five sad songs about the things he's seeing after the destruction of Jerusalem. Who destroyed Jerusalem? Well, none other than Nebuchadnezzar. And Daniel was taken away. Daniel was taken away from his homeland. He was taken to Babylon. Why was he taken away? What do you think about that? Why was Daniel taken away? Because he was actually useful. Babylon, and the authorities in Babylon said, we're going to go in and we're just not going to kill everybody. That would be wasteful. We're going to see who is useful, what people are intelligent, what people can be of use to us, and we're going to take them just like you would take gold or silver. We're going to take the people and we're going to make them serve us. We're going to make them counsel us. We're going to make them, put them to work in our purposes, okay? And Daniel was one of the ones who was deemed to be of that caliber that he would be useful to Babylon. Okay, let's start in verse 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. The Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand. Notice how that history is stated. The Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand. How would any other historian state it? If you were just looking at it through history, how would you put that down on paper? Well, obviously, Babylon is superior in knowledge. They're superior in might. They're superior in their army. They have better tech. They have better weaponry. They're just better. The giant one. The same way if the United States went against Cuba, or the United States went against Guatemala, and the United States won, you'd say, well, that just makes sense, does it not? That's just common sense. The bigger, stronger, more equipped team won. That's not how it's stated, though. Why did Babylon win? The Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah. And this is key in understanding this whole lesson. Because if you're thinking along the lines, as the New Testament would say, according to the flesh, you would say, well, that just makes sense. Of course, Babylon's going to win. But no, this has a purpose. There's somebody behind all of this. A story is unfolding here. Okay, the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the vessels of the house of God, and he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God. Now you think, why would God do that? Wouldn't that be running through your mind if you were a captive in Babylon? Maybe this story is a little too convenient. Let's see, we lost, I'm a captive. All the stuff that was in our temple is in their temple now. Maybe I need to reconsider my beliefs. Because reality is mugging me. Reality is slapping me in the face. And I have to say, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I have to have a little humility here. To the house of his God, and he brought the vessels into the treasury of his God. Then the king ordered Ashpenaz, the chief of his officials, to bring in some of the sons of Israel, including some of the royal family and of the nobles, youths, in whom was no defect, who were good-looking, showing intelligence in every branch of wisdom, endowed with understanding and discerning knowledge, and who had ability for serving in the king's court, and he ordered him to teach them the literature and language of the Chaldeans. The king appointed for them a daily ration from the king's choice food and from the wine which he drank, and appointed that they should be educated 3 years, at the end of which they were to enter the king's personal service. So basically, they're going to college. They're going to learn the language. They're going to learn the literature. They're going to learn about the society. They're going to be made useful for the king's purposes. Useful in the hand of the king. And, you know, you think about this. You think about Daniel at this time, ripped away from his family, ripped away from his homeland in a foreign land. In a foreign land that is very impressive, that is flowing with knowledge, that is flowing with all kinds of wonders everywhere you look. The hanging gardens over here, if they ever existed, but many say they do. The hanging gardens, a marvel, one of the wonders of the ancient world. But even the gate, you go in this gate, this bright shining topaz, these lions, it's a wonder. You have to say, how is this in the reach of any human to be able to do? There's nothing like this back in Jerusalem. We had the temple, that was fine, but there's nothing like this. Even their gates better than the best of our architecture. And everywhere you look, there's marvels. There's knowledge. The medicine's better. Everything is better. And can you see how that maps on to us today? We're strangers, pilgrims here in this world. And in the world, are there any marvels? Are there any wonders? Of course. Look at those jets. Look at those helicopters. Look at those rockets. Look at that medicine. Look at all that machinery. Look at all the knowledge we have. And you have to say, you can't lie about it. You have to say, wow, that's really impressive. That's incredible. But the question is that all there is? Or is there something more than that, something beyond that? And for us, it's a lot easier because we have all the stories of the Bible and we have a Bible. For Daniel, as a young man, ripped away from his homeland, ripped away from his family, before the time of books, without the Levites there to teach him, he has to stand on his convictions, purely on his convictions. And we'll see that he does that. And it's something that we need to learn from. And you look at the counterexamples. People who, when faced with the oncoming tide, when faced with the world wanting, what's the world want you to do? We want you to conform. You need to conform to us. When we say there can be two men can get married or two women can get married, what do you say? You say, yes, sir. That's what you say. When we say that a man can become a woman and a woman can become a man, you say, yes, sir. You conform. You compromise. Why? So you can get along. You go along to get along. You stand up, you're going to get knocked down. So this genuflect, just bow down and go along with what we say. That's going to be the position Daniel is in. That's the position we are in the world. That's the position every person who has convictions is in the world. Because we can't just go along to get along. No, we have to stand for something. Okay, verse 5. The king appointed, verse 5 of chapter 1. The king appointed for them a daily ration from the king's choice food and from the wine which he drank, and appointed that they should be educated 3 years, at the end of which they were to enter the king's personal service. Now among them from the sons of Judah were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Then the commander of the officers assigned new names to them. And to Daniel he assigned the name Belteshazzar, to Ananias Shadrach, to Mishael Meshach, and to Azariah Abednego. Now notice this. Well, that just makes sense that they would assign them new names because you want names that are comport with your language. But what is that doing? When you're given a new name, I own you. You are mine. This is your new name. You belong to me. And not only to add insult to injury, what is Daniel's name? Do you notice that has Baal in it? That's their god. You belong to me. This is your new name. You are a slave in a foreign land, and you are mine. Kind of got sidetracked there. You think about counterexamples to Daniel, people who could not stand against the tide. Who do you think about? There are two I think about. I think about Aaron. When Moses is up there on the mountain, receiving the law of God from angels. What's Aaron doing down there? He's giving in to peer pressure. That's what he's doing. And, you know, you could see that situation. Well, Moses has been up on that mountain and he didn't take much food, or he didn't take any food, and it's been 40 days. Obviously, he's dead. We've got to do something, you know. And Aaron says, well, basically, the people forced me. They wanted a god, so they gave me the stuff. I threw it in there, now came this calf. Now, what's even more impressive about Daniel is that Aaron at that time was 85 years old, around 85. You'd think he would have a little more backbone than that. He'd be a little more developed. Daniel's a very young man. Another counterexample, Saul. Saul, remember what God told Saul to do? Kill everything. Annihilate everything. Destroy everything. And then Samuel comes and he asks, what's all this noise I hear? Why do I hear these animals? Why do I hear that you have not carried out the word of the Lord? And he said, well, basically, I was scared of the people. Now, Saul wasn't as old as Aaron, but he was older than Daniel. And plus, he wasn't a servant. He was the king. So we can't make excuses. Well, if I were a king or if I were older, I would be able to stand. No, you stand irregardless of your situation. Sometimes those who have the most difficult situations show the most resolve, show the most strength. You can't use your situation as a crutch, as an excuse. No. Okay, verse 8, but Daniel made up his mind that he would not defile himself from the king's choice food or with the wine which he drank, so he sought permission from the commander of the officials that he might not defile himself. Okay, what about that? What do you take from that? He made the firm decision. He made a covenant with himself. He agreed with himself that I am not going to defile myself. Think about a situation. A slave in a foreign land, barely speaks the language, being trained to be in the king's court. And not only that, the king is giving you food. The king is giving you wine. And you have the temerity, you have from the king's eyes, the pride to say, no, I refuse that food. It's not fit for me. Don't you know I could have killed you? Don't you know I can kill you at any time? And I'm giving you something, and you say no? How arrogant. But he says, what's his decision process? This is going to defile me. This is a compromise. And I'm not going to compromise. Some things are non-negotiable. I am not going to do this under any circumstance. Now, what was it about the king's food or the king's wine that made Daniel think that it was a compromise? Well, we're not told, so we're not going to go there. What is important is that to Daniel, it was a compromise to accept it. Whatever reason it was, he says, this is going to compromise me, and I am not going to do that, and I'm going to be firm in that. Notice verse 9. Do you remember how in verse 2 it says, the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand? Look at verse 9. And God granted Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the commander of the officials. Who's unfolding this story? Well, you know, some nations just beat other nations. Some kings rise, some kings go down. Some things happen in the world. No, God is unfolding this story. God is the one who's in control. God is the author of this story. Okay, let's turn over to chapter, I think we all know how that story ends. Let's turn over to chapter 3 to see another example of this. Standing firm against the tide. When everything is against you, when everything is seeking to harm you, when everything is seeking to make you compromise your position, to tell you you better get in line and you better step with the world, and you think, well, that would make things a lot easier. That certainly would make things a lot easier. Yes, in the short term it would, but what about the long term? The short term, of course, is going to make everything easier. You go along to get along. That's the saying, because it actually works. Don't make any trouble, and no trouble will come to you. But the question is, what about the long term? Okay, in verse 1 of chapter 3, Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold, the height of which was 60 cubits and the width 6 cubits. Strange proportions, 10 to 1 proportions. It had been interesting to look at. He set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon, and Nebuchadnezzar the king sent word to assemble the satraps, the prefects, and the governors and the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the rulers of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. Then the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the rulers of the provinces were assembled for the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up, and they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then the herald loudly proclaims, "To you the command is given." Notice that. To you the command is given. Not the option, not the suggestion, the command. You will fall in line. There's only one way to be saved, to trust and obey. You must trust and obey Nebuchadnezzar. You must trust and obey the government. Then the herald loudly proclaimed, "To you the command is given, O peoples, nations, the men of every language." Don't think because you're a foreigner you can get away with not bowing down. In fact, this was probably a clever way for the government to unite everybody in fear, to unite everybody in one religion. And who's the god of that religion? Well, none other than the king. None other than the king. So everyone's united under one ruler, our shepherd, the king, Nebuchadnezzar. Verse 5, that at the moment you hear, notice that, at the moment, don't dilly-dally, don't take your time, this is urgent. This is urgent. As soon as you hear, the moment you hear the sound of the horn, flute, lyre, trigon, psaltery, bagpipe, and the kinds of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king has set up. Okay, and what if we don't? I'm sure at that time there's a rebellious streak in some, just as in every time. And what if we don't, king? But whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately, notice, you shall immediately fall down and worship, and if you don't, there will be some urgency, shall immediately be cast into the midst of a furnace of blazing fire. Do you fear the fire? Do you want to be burned up? Well, you better obey. This is no, what do you think? Do you think this is empty words? Sometimes, in modern times, governments will give false red lines. You cross this line, and this is going to happen. Somebody crosses it, and nothing happens. These aren't empty words. Therefore, at that time, verse 7, therefore at that time, when all the peoples heard the sound of the horn, flute, lyre, trigon, psaltery, bagpipe, and all kinds of music, and all the peoples, nations, and men of every language fell down and worshipped the golden image and Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. Notice the intelligence in making it based off of music as well, because no matter what language you speak, no matter how intelligent you are, how advanced your vocabulary is, you know when you hear that music playing, you get on your face and you worship the king's image. And if you're there in Babylon, you're a slave in Babylon, and everybody else is doing it, and if you don't do it, you're going to be thrown into the fiery furnace, you're going to be sacrificed and made an example of for all others to see. Hey, don't end up like those three idiots who wouldn't do the simplest thing, but chose to not compromise, and therefore they're ashes. Don't be like them. Have some sense. Have some reasoning. Think about it. They thought their God was going to protect them, the same God that delivered them into my hand, the same God whose things I have in my God's temple. That's what they thought, but now they're dead. For this reason, verse 8, for this reason, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and brought charges against the Jews. They responded and said to Nebuchadnezzar the king, O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound of the horn, flute, lyre, trigon, psaltery, and bagpipe, and all kinds of music, is to fall down and worship the golden image. But whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into the midst of the furnace of blazing fire. There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the administration of the province of Babylon, namely, we're not going to give names here, namely Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Now you say, really? Only those three? Don't you think there were more Jews than that? I would think so. We're not sure why Daniel's not here. Daniel lives on after this. But these are the three. Apparently they had made some very high enemies. Some enemies in very high places. Very important enemies. And these enemies, you know, the world in general is out to get you. The world in general is out to make you bow. The world in general is out to make you compromise and conform you to its liking. But these three had garnered for themselves very special enemies. Enemies that went to great lengths to make sure that they would meet their untimely fate in a fire that would burn them to a crisp. These men, O king, have disregarded you. We're really upset for you, king. We were offended on your behalf. They did not serve your gods or worship the golden image which you have set up. How do you think Nebuchadnezzar reacted to that? If you're Nebuchadnezzar, how often do you encounter rebellion like that, you think? Well, not very often, and if you do, it's not for very long, because whoever rebels is going to be soon gone. And so many people know that there's not a lot of rebellion. There's a lot of yes men. Oh, that sounds great, king. That's wonderful, king. Sure. How low do you want me to go? For how long? Sure, whatever you say, king. Then Nebuchadnezzar, in rage and anger, gave orders to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Then these men were brought before the king. Nebuchadnezzar responded and said to them, is it true? He couldn't believe it. How could this be? How could you be so stupid? You were deemed to be intelligent. You've been in my service. I know you're intelligent men. How could you be so foolish? Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you did not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? Now, if you are ready at the moment, you hear the sound of the horn, flute, lyre, trigon, psaltery, and bagpipe, and all kinds of music to fall down and worship the image that I have made, very well. That is, I'm going to give you a pass. Maybe you misunderstood something. Maybe you didn't hear it quite clearly. Maybe there's some misunderstanding. But if you'll just compromise now, if you'll just bow now, if you'll just say, yes, king, now that we're before your throne, we cannot do anything but compromise. Very well, but if you do not worship, you will immediately be cast into the midst of a furnace of blazing fire. And what God is there who can deliver you out of my hands? Now, this is a legitimate question. What God is there? You think Nebuchadnezzar had ever thrown anybody in that furnace before? I would say so. And you know what happens every single time? They go in and they die. It's 100% of the time they go in and they die. And all those had other gods. They all had gods. And by the way, the god you say you serve, you know, we just kind of conquered you and destroyed your temple, and his stuff's in our temple. So who are you talking about? What kind of miracle are you expecting here? Verse 16, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to give you an answer concerning this matter. Now think about how infuriating that would be. I'm Nebuchadnezzar the Great, the builder of the great Babylon. Nobody says no to me. You know, I think he would probably think of himself as he describes God there at the end of chapter 4. You know, who can ask him anything? Who can say, what have you done? Who can ward off his hand? Nobody can ward off my hand. And I've got proof. Look at my throne. Look at this great empire. Look, your eyes aren't lying to you. Be sensible. Who's going to save you from my hand? Who saved you from being my servant? Nobody. Who's going to save you now? Nobody. Okay. But what did they say? If it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the furnace of blazing fire. Do we have faith in God to deliver us? That he can deliver us? Yes, we do. Our God can deliver us. The question is, will he? Now, that's a good question. How many Christians have been slaughtered throughout the history of the world? How many followers of God have been slaughtered? When they were feeding the Christians to the lion, how many times was there some miraculous intervention? When people were sawn in two, how many times were there miraculous interventions? That is to say, you have no reason to expect that there's going to be some miraculous intervention. I have no reason to expect. I should expect exactly what any thinking person would expect. He throws me into that fire, I'm going to die. Yes, God can save me, but the question is, will he? Why should I expect that he would unless he told me? Unless I had some revelation. Because the majority of time that people are persecuted, the majority of time that people are threatened for following God, for following Jesus, you know, when somebody shoots them, they die. When somebody feeds them to a lion, they die. When somebody lights them on fire, they burn. That's what happens. So we know that God is able, but notice this, even if he doesn't, even if we're forced to suffer the flames of that fire, is that going to change our minds? Is that going to make us bow down to you instead of to him? Absolutely not. If he deems us worthy to go into that fire and to burn up, we still are not going to render obedience to you, O King. We're going to render obedience to him. Verse 17, if it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the furnace of blazing fire, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O King. But even if he does not, let it be known to you, O King, that we are not going to serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. Whatever happens, know this, we are not going to compromise ourselves to get along. We are ready to suffer the consequences. And many people have this idea of Christianity, of following God, that everything's going to be sunshine and rainbows. No, there are going to be many difficulties, and there are going to be many obstacles you have to overcome, and you have to have the right mindset. I am resolved to follow Jesus, including when things are going horribly, including when certain death is at my doorstep. I'm resolved that I'm not going to waver, that I'm not going to back down. And I've actually thought about this. What would happen in this situation? What would I say? What would I do? And why? Very important. There's always a how when there's a why. And why would I do that? When you think about it abstractly, are we going to serve God or man?
And Nebuchadnezzar's, from a human perspective, is seems so elevated to all other men, yet he's so far away from God. We're going to serve God. Now, that's easier to say up here. When nobody's threatening to throw me in the fiery furnace, it's very easy to say. This rolls off the tongue. No, I'm not going to do that. Well, good for you for saying that. But when push comes to shove, and when there's, you can feel the heat from the fire, do you still have the resolve? That's the question. And these few people, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, yes, they had the resolve. But even if he does not, let it be known to you, O king, that we are not going to serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. Why would we serve and worship the creation instead of the creator? We fear a fire that is to come much more than your fire. We fear a fire that is unquenchable. We fear a fire that doesn't pass, whose flames don't do their damage and then it's all over, but whose flames last forever. That's the fire we fear. Your fire is nothing. And what's the New Testament tell us? Don't fear men. Don't fear men. Honor the king, but fear God. You only fear God. Why? Because anything a man can do to you is temporary. And again, it's very easy for me up here in my shirt and tie in this nice air-conditioned room to say that. It really takes no guts, no discipline, no resolve to say it up here. But the situation may arise where, yes, I have to be resolved to say, I don't care what you do to me. I don't care. I am not going to bow. Then, verse 19, then Nebuchadnezzar was filled with wrath. You dare to speak against me, a God on earth, like this? And his facial expression was altered toward Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He answered by giving order to heat the furnace 7 times more than it was usually heated. Heated up to maximum capacity. Now, I doubt that it could actually be heated 7 times what, or they could even measure it, but heated up to max. Throw as much wood, as much coal in there as you can. Let them be an example to everyone else. This is what happens when you anger a God on earth. He commanded certain valiant warriors who were in his army to tie up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in order to cast them into the furnace of blazing fire. Then these men were tied up in their trousers, their coats, their caps, and their other clothes, and were cast into the midst of the furnace of blazing fire. For this reason, because the king's command was urgent, and the furnace had been made extremely hot, the flame of the fire slew those men who carried up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. But these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell into the midst of the furnace of blazing fire, still tied up. So you can picture it. Get this fire as hot as you can get it, as soon as you can get it. Tie these men up. They're not just going to walk in there. You got to tie them up, and then let's have some people go up and throw them in there. Obviously, you'd have to be quite valiant to throw a full-grown man in there. But the people that got up close to throw them in, the fire was so hot, and they had to get up there so close to put them in there that they were offed by the flames. Verse 24, then Nebuchadnezzar the king was astounded and stood up in haste. He said to his high officials, was it not 3 men we cast bound into the midst of the fire? They replied to the king, certainly, O king, of course. Absolutely, O king. He said, look, I see 4 men, and not only 4 men, 4 men loosed and walking about in the midst of the fire without harm, and the appearance of the fourth is like a son of the gods. Then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the door of the furnace of the blazing fire. He responded and said, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, come out. You know, what happens? What happens when we stand up against the tide? When everyone else around you is bending the knee? When everyone else around you is saying, yes, sir, yes, ma'am, we sure will say that, we sure will think that, and you stand up against the tide, what does that do? What kind of effect does that have on other people? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, come out, you servants. Of who? Remember the question, who is the God that will save you from my hand? Well, he's just been demonstrated. You servants of the Most High God, and come here. Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out of the midst of the fire. The satraps, the prefects, the governors, and the king's high officials gathered around them and saw in regard to these men that the fire had no effect on the bodies of these men, nor was the hair of their head singed, nor were their trousers damaged, nor had the smell of fire even come upon them. So they were not affected by the threat of King Nebuchadnezzar, even superficially. Not even superficially. No effect. They were protected from those fires by, obviously, by the hand of God. Supernaturally protected. Nebuchadnezzar responded and said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants who put their trust in him." They were rewarded for their trust. For trusting in God, they were rewarded. I gave them the option. Are you going to bow before me? Or are you going to hold fast to your uncompromising position? And they chose to trust in their God. And now they're going to be rewarded. His servants who put their trust in him, violating the king's commands. I like how he says the king's. Violating my commands. And yielded up their bodies so as not to serve or worship any god except their own God. Therefore I make a decree that any people, nation, or tongue that speaks anything offensive against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb, and their house is reduced to a rubbish heap, inasmuch as there is no other God who is able to deliver in this way. As I said, he was asking a legitimate question. I've never seen with my eyes, I've never heard of any other God that could do this. And now I've seen that this God, but I know there's no other. There's no other God that can do this. Inasmuch as there is no other God who is able to deliver in this way. Then the king caused Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to prosper in the province of Babylon. So, being resolute, being resolved to stand on your conviction, saying whatever may happen, and very important point, not expecting a miracle, but saying, I'm willing to accept whatever consequences come my way. And the consequences could be severe. They could be loss of friends, loss of family, troubles at work, troubles in the community. The consequences could be severe, but you say, I'm ready to sacrifice all of that to stand on my principles. And, you know, we have some younger people here. I think about especially younger people going into, they're out of college, but younger people going into college. What is that world? That's much like the world of Daniel. Taken from your home, brought into a world with walls covered in ivy, and they say, yeah, they taught you these things, but here's the truth. Are any of the people in your circle as eloquent as this professor? Do any of them have as many letters after their name as this professor? Do you look to any of the people in your circle when you're sick, or do you go to a doctor? When you want to get somewhere, do you go to, you know, that nice church lady, or do you go to an engineer who's designed a 747? So who's really got the truth? Let me ask you, why are you so arrogant? That's the thing, that's the idea that is portrayed to the youth these days, and indeed to even older people. that you need to stop being so arrogant. You need to look around at great Babylon and realize that your pathetic Jerusalem cannot compare. We have the truth. We've conquered you. We have all the answers. But that's simply not true. There's some things that science cannot answer. There's some things that the knowledge of this world cannot answer. There's some things, and it happens to be that they're the most important things that are outside of the reach of science, that are outside of the reach of human knowledge. And we have to understand how to separate those things. I enjoy technology. I enjoy medicine. Try not to enjoy medicine, but if I need it, it's great to have. I enjoy driving in my car at 70 miles an hour down the, strapped into a seat, going 70 miles an hour, where the rain and the snow can affect me. It's amazing. You ever think about that as you're driving there? I'm in a seat, strapped in, going 75 miles an hour down the road. That's an amazing thing. How fast can a horse run? Not very fast compared to a car. It's an amazing thing. I'm in the 747. I'm going 800 miles an hour. Amazing. I'm video conferencing with someone around the world. I'm having robots doing surgery on me, and I'm going to be healed the next day. It's amazing. But there are limits to it, and there are things outside of it, and we can't be fooled into thinking that knowledge is fungible. Because this person knows everything about aerospace engineering means they know something about religion. No. And often you'll see this error made. Well, that person is a great doctor. Let's hear what he thinks about politics. Well, he might not know anything about politics. You know stuff in your own area. You need to stick in that area. But that's the lie that is sold. We have all the answers. Your parents were wrong. Your church was wrong, especially. The Bible is wrong. We've got the answers. Why would you look to that ancient text written by fishermen? Why would you look to that? Well, it was written by a lot of fishermen, but the ultimate author is God. The same author, he is the author not only of the Bible, but also the author of you. And you say, look at all these wonders and marvels that are made by the hands of humans, yes. And the builder is worthy of more honor than the creation, but you have to ask the question, who is the builder of the builder? Who is the builder of man in his great mind? Well, it's God. God is the giver of life. He's the author of all life. He's the author of the universe. And he is the one who is due all glory and honor. So don't be fooled. Stand fast in your convictions. Don't bow the knee to the world when the world tells you, well, the Bible says this, but here's the actual truth. The Bible says this, but it's the year 2023. The Bible says this, but it's antiquated. Those were fishermen in the Bronze Age. And no, I'm going to stand fast. No matter what you do to me, I'm going to stand fast. I will not compromise, and I'm going to follow God till the end, whatever happens, because I trust in him, and I fear his fire more than I fear your fire. And I trust in his goodness more than I trust in your goodness. And I will not bow to you, but I will bow to God. And I will continue to do so till the end, fully trusting in him, not even in myself, but in him who is able to deliver me. So as we're in the world, there are all kinds of troubles. There are all kinds of challenges. New challenges, new troubles every day. But God gives blessings anew every day as well. And we need to learn to trust in those and to struggle on, struggling every day until we reach our final goal, and not giving up and not compromising.